qua non ci deve essere più niente. Bisogna cominciare subito. Coraggio, al lavoro, buttate giù. Dico bene, autore?
Sì, grazie. Arrivederci, ragazzi. Ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.
Welcome to Cinema Italia, a podcast dedicated to the world of Italian cinema. Presented by me, John Bleasdale. And welcome to Cinema Italia. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a film critic, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Matthew Page, who is a writer on cinema and faith. He's written a book about 100 Bible films, and he's also an expert in Italian cinema. So this is a perfect combination of film and guest. Welcome to the podcast, Matthew.
Thanks very much, John. It's good to be here again. I really enjoyed listening to this podcast, so it's really nice to kind of join in episode as well. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. Welcome back, because you were here for our brilliant episode, if I say so myself, on the Pasolini film, The Gospel According to St. Matthew.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, really enjoyed that one. So
that was the gospel to according to St. Matthew, according to Matthew Page.
So. Yeah.
How many Matthews? It was Matthew Rich, shall we say?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's always kind of partly why that, you know, that gospel's always had a bit of an extra affiliation because of the name connection, I suppose. So natural that spilled over into film, perhaps. But
it's funny how you connect to things by names, isn't it? I remember I was brought up Catholic, and I remember saying to the priest once, why don't we always call God Peter God? Because my dad was Peter as well, and I was an altar boy, and I'd misheard thanks be to God as thanks Peter God. And I was like, and he used that for a sermon, making me deeply proud as well of my little stupidity. It was an introduction to even if people are laughing at you, they're still not ignoring you.
So. Yeah. Brilliant.
So we're talking about a new filmmaker, not really a new filmmaker. This film goes back to 2011. Corpo Celeste is a film by actually, do you want to introduce her and introduce the film a little bit?
Yeah, so it's a film by an Italian filmmaker called Alice Rowacca, who has this was kind of her first film. She'd worked a little bit on documentaries before that, but hadn't kind of gone the film school route into things. She'd kind of done, I think, philosophy and as her kind of first degree, but had a lot of interest in painting and literature, and then kind of found herself and hadn't really done, you know, hadn't really come from a home where there'd been a lot of, you know, filmmaking. She hadn't had a kind of video camera at home or done anything like that, and they didn't have a local cinema in her local town, and in some ways her prior existence was quite a kind of rural existence. And so there's a little bit of autobiography with her in this film and the character, in that, you know, she had kind of also experienced that moving from the sticks to the city, kind of changing lifestyle. And she did this documentary also with producer Carlo Crestadina. And then he basically kind of massaged her into writing a script for a film, and then at a later stage she kind of says, and she was kind of wondering who was going to direct it. She was happy to do the writing, and she kind of gradually realized that he had her in the frame to direct it, and then they pitched it, and it took them 4 years to get it made, but they made it in 2011. And since then she's done three other features, Le Meraviglie, The Wonders, in 2014, I think it was, with starring, the first time that she worked with her sister, Alba Rowacca, who's would you say she's one of Italy's leading actors at the moment, Alba?
She's certainly for the for this kind of film, for the sort of the Italian art house circuit, she is she is ubiquitous. You know, she's everywhere. And that doesn't mean by art house, I don't mean it's very, very small. I mean, she'll be in major films as well, but she'll be in sort of kind of serious films rather than sort of the cinema panettone or the or the sort of more popular end of the spectrum.
Yeah. So, and rightly so as well. She's a, you know, she's a brilliant actor. And also Monica Bellucci was in that film. And then 2017, Lazzaro Felice, Happy as Lazzaro. And then just at the moment, depending on where you are in the country or in the world, sorry, then La Chimera is rolling out. So, which I've not seen yet because I'm in the UK and we don't get it for another few weeks. But I think you've seen it, John, haven't you?
Yeah. I've seen all her films. I was just thinking about them as you were mentioning them. I didn't realize that I'd seen them all, actually, but as you went through them, I realized I had. Yes, La Chimera is, I saw at Cannes. I was just reading through my review prior to this podcast to sort of remind myself. I think I reviewed it for next big picture or next best picture, a blog which sort of part of its raison d'être is the sort of looking at awards and festivals and awards and things.
Yeah,
it's a very good film. It's funny that you mentioned that about her sort of coming almost reluctantly to filmmaking, or certainly not going the route of sort of, I want to be a film director, I steep myself in cinema culture and all the rest of it, because all of her films are almost sort of applauding and celebrating a sort of amateurishness, a sort of ragtagness of community. And La Chimera does that as well, has that sort of a sort of alternate society of sort of go-getters, but who don't work by the rules of normal society. So it kind of mirrors her own entry into Italian film. And I mean, you mentioned that it took 4 years to get Corpo Celeste made, but that strikes me as a very short period of time.
for a first feature as well.
I would say that's the low average. That's the quick average rather than particularly long. Yeah. So it's La Chimera. I think it sounds like I'm damning it by faint praise, but it's definitely a sort of 3.5 to 4 stars if you want to go that star route. It's definitely well worth a watch. And I think if you've liked her other films, I think there's a lot to appreciate here. And of course it stars everyone's favorite tennis player, Joseph O'Connor, the challengers. And I mean, he's having a moment at the moment, as the kids say, and well worth it.
Yeah. I've also not had a chance to see challengers and seen that on Tuesday. So
I'm seeing that tonight. We're recording this on Monday, just so everybody knows.
Yeah.
Everyone can follow our plans.
Yeah. Come stalk us.
Yes.
Yeah.
The baby reindeer style. I can see it's interesting that you chose this film because I think in the past we've talked on Writers on Film and we've talked, as I said earlier on the Pasolini film, and I've read your book and it's sort of directly about films dealing with religious sources, you know, source material. Yeah. And this is actually a little bit of a departure because it's about religious faith.
Yes, I mean those films have always interested me as well. I mean, I think with my book, I kind of felt I had to focus it down on where my natural allegiances lay in some way. But I think this was a film that when I first saw it, it just really grabbed me by the throat, I think. And I think partly because of that. So I don't go to church anymore, but it just kind of reminded me so much of my experience when I was younger. I think I maybe went to church for longer than you did, John. Kind of well into my 30s. But I think I was from. And I mean, I'd be kind of interested to hear about how it kind of reflected on your experience in the church. Because for me, I kind of I was baptized a Catholic initially, and then my parents were kind of. One was Catholic, one was C of E, and they kind of settled on the C of E age around 5 and then moved towards a kind of more evangelical version of that. And this was kind of 80s, 90s kind of time. So And I think just so much of her experience just felt really, you know, just felt it really captured those experiences of mine growing up in a way that is, I think, very rarely done in cinema. I think there's quite often portrayals of the church, they tend to either swing kind of saccharine or evil, and they tend to focus very much on the kind of the priests that perhaps catch this, you know, one extreme or the other. I'm also Tuesday going to go and see On the Waterfront on the big screen, which I'm excited about. And it obviously has a fantastic priest character in it. And then you also get ones that are more on the more despicable end of the scale. But I think what it felt like, but you don't often see much about the kind of normal people in the pews and the people that are very often the heart of those communities that are kind of keeping them running on the day to day as well. And you have the character Santa here, who again is, you know, there are positives and negatives. I mean, I think there's just such nuance in all the characters, and they feel so three-dimensional and so real and so kind of well fleshed out that it just kind of captures something for me that I don't think I think is very rare in the movies, in terms of, I suppose, that idea of, you know, religious community and what those communities can be and their strengths and some of their weaknesses. I mean, how does it reflect your experiences, would you say? Sorry, I know it's putting that back on you, but
no, I love it. I love it. I love the conversation. I was a very intense Catholic, and so I really, really feel for Marta in this film, who is the 13-year-old protagonist. I was an altar boy, as I said earlier, and as such, I went to mass three times a day. Three times a week, three times a day. Yeah. Still, three times a week is a lot, but it was like it was like Tuesday, Thursdays, and Sundays. And I also would serve for weddings and funerals if they came our way as well. So that was from that would have been from like 6 or 7 until 16. So solid 10 yeah. years of three times a week. And I, you know, was I went to a Catholic primary school, and I went to a Catholic school. And so it was very intense. And at one point, I even thought I had a conversion. I think it might have been a little bit, to the extent that I went to the priest and actually talked about, you know, what would it mean to become a priest and all this sort of stuff. And that was kind of like the peak of my religiosity, if you like. And then at 16, lost my faith, kind of quite in a sort of inverse Damascene revelation, sort of, you know.
Yeah,
turned around and went, no, this is all of it collapsed. More recently, I kind of have more sympathy for religious questions. I don't see them as in a religious. I don't see any religion giving me the answers.
Yeah,
but the actual religious questions I find interesting, and I've become much more open to asking them. You know, the why are we here sort of questions. And I do go back to people like Paul Tillich, the theologian of that sort of ground of being version of God, which is, I find fascinating, even though, again, I would classify myself quite robustly as an atheist. I'm not, I'm an atheist who asks himself a lot of serious questions, a lot of religious questions, I should say.
Yeah.
I don't see atheism as the answer. I see it as a point from which to continue to ask the questions. Okay, so that's where I am. As far as the film goes, I thought it was brilliant, and I agree with you totally that it really, really captures the sort of mundane day-to-day concerns of a parish church, and how much there is a gap between the idea of faith and the mystery and the magic and the all of those things, which the deep questions of existence and all of those things, and the reality of cold churches and ping pong and the rather feeble attempts to sort of put together communities and keep together communities and express that faith in some way. You know, there's a bit where they sort of play blindman's buff as a way of, you know, of illustrating what faith means.
Yeah.
And it
just metaphors.
Yeah, exactly. And that gap is huge, you know, is massive. And actually, if I'm sorry, it's a bit of a ramble, but it kind of that kind of relates a little bit to me, that sort of use of a metaphor to express to the children, this is what believing in God means, or this is what is exactly why I lost my faith. Was we were the school that I was a part of sent everyone up to the Lake District for a spiritual retreat at 16 because they wanted everybody to go off and they kind of, it was the last chance before you went off into the godless world to really get you. And it was very hip, and there were young priests and all this sort of stuff. And there was a priest who did this thing where he got you to go outside in the night and pick up a rock and then come into this lovely chapel with candlelight and everything. And you lay on the floor and you held the rock in your hand. And he said, this rock is like God because it's been there when you were, before you were born, it was there. It'll be there after you die, and it exists and it continues to exist. And it was just such a beautiful, thoughtful, interesting spiritual idea.
Yeah.
And after the morning after, we were on a bell walk, and I said to this girl who, you know, complete transparency, I kind of fancied, I said to her, wasn't that amazing last night, the thing about the rock and the spiritualism and da 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 da, and she went, no, it was bullshit. And I just sort of went, oh, and just even the idea that you could dismiss it like that, and the idea that really once it was dismissed, I couldn't come up with an argument. Oh no, but it's, you know, she was like, it's just a rock. God, yeah, rock exists. It doesn't mean anything about God, you know. That it just, I just thought, oh, is that the best you've got? Is that it? And it was, there was no looking back from there. So it was hormones partly, I'm sure. Yeah. But that's Marta's situation here. But I mean, to get back to the film a little bit, as much as it's interesting that we're confessing. Why don't we get a sort of précis of the an introduction to the film so people know where we are?
Yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it? Marta is a 13-year-old girl who has recently moved from Switzerland to Reggio in Calabria, which, for those people that don't know, Italy is right at the very kind of, it's the kind of the big toe of the boot, so to speak. And so she's kind of not used to the kind of the life of the city, and really it's a way of looking, I suppose, at the city and of the community of faith there through her eyes. And so the kind of major of, and it seems that what the kind of one of the key ways you experience the community of Reggio is through the church there. And so her mum enrolls her in catechism class to kind of go through and do her first communion. She's kind of that age. And so it's kind of, it kind of juxtaposes a few things. So you've got this kind of idea of this newcomer to the city, this kind of someone coming from the countryside to, and from a different country, to seeing this culture, you know, through their kind of naive eyes. You've got a kind of a coming of age element going on as well, in terms of her changing body, her changing outlook, her changing kind of, you know, just discovering more about herself. And you've got this I suppose relatively intense process of going through communion, but it's about, you know, so much more about that. It's about her kind of general life and the dynamics in her family, and I think, you know, it is a kind of commentary on not just on the kind of the church and the state of the church, but I think actually what Alicia Rorick is doing is kind of using that as a way of looking at the kind of the bigger society and you know, and some of the other issues that she sees around. And she kind of talks about, I mean, in terms of how it's shot, I think one of the things that's very apparent, particularly in this film, but in her other films as well, is the kind of the unseen places in cinema. And you know, she kind of talks about how the more popular images of Reggio, which is, you know, there's a kind of, she said, I've never been, but I understand from what she said, that there's a kind of 800 meter stretch of beach that's beautiful, and there's some beautiful buildings, and they're the bits that tend to get seen. But the but the kind of the rest of it on the back streets and the kind of some of the other areas, which are, you know, much more run down, tend not to be seen, and the people that kind of inhabit those places and their lives, and this is really a kind of an up close look at all of that, really, it, as I say, in a way that really crystallizes, really crystallizes that experience into real people and real, you know, what feels like real people and real situations.
If you watch Ripley or White Lotus and think that's the only, you know, side of Italy, that's the very much, it's sort of beautiful old buildings and crumbling grandeur and as you say, white beaches and blue seas and everything.
Yeah, and pristine kind of crisp cinematography and all those things, which...
I think it's almost like a point of pride in some Italian filmmakers to sort of go to the ugliest places they can, or not necessarily ugly, you know, there's certainly beautiful shots in here, but there's a context which is, you know, I'm thinking of Matteo Garrone, who tends to film a lot in Ostia and places like that, and very run down areas, and the name of the Jonas Carpignano, who did films. Acchiara was probably his most famous film.
Yeah,
that came out in Acciambra, I think he was another one he did, where he's looking at poor communities, and there are kind of, I mean, in Italy you've got the south, which Reggio Calabria is as south as you can get, really, without leaving the mainland, and so in many ways, actually, Marta is moving backwards because she's moving from a very integrated European country, Switzerland, and coming to like the toe end of Italy, which is far away from wealthy Italy. It's far away from like the Italy in the north is where you want to be if you want to, you know, make some money or have a job, even, you know. Rates of unemployment in Reggio Calabria are very, very high compared to the rest of the country, for instance.
And part of that kind of long-standing, you know, long-standing kind of historical sense of the north looking down on the south and the south being rural. And that's been a subject for, you know, numerous filmmakers throughout the decades, hasn't it? In terms of like, you know, telling the story of the south and perhaps sort of migration northwards or the kind of the situations for that, and certainly, you know, in neorealism there's a lot of focus on that, and I think there are certainly neorealistic elements in this film as well, which and I think it's it's always one it's, I suppose it's one of the cliches of Italian cinema that everyone post 1946 has to kind of been pitched as to where they are in relation to neorealism, and you know which elements they take up and which elements they don't. But it does feel like there are certainly elements of that she draws on and gives real vitality to. So this is it is about the lives of ordinary people. She is using everyday non-professional actors mixed in with professional actors. So those elements are really well done, and I think are partly what gives. Yeah, it gives this its sense of reality, really.
There's a definite sense that she's participating in a community, but a lot like a documentary filmmaker would be. And she's going there and finding things as much as she is sort of scripting moments. And, you know, she's, I can't say this in terms of, you know, from a position of strength, but it certainly seems to me that she's, she's not making stuff up here. She's either taking it from her own childhood or she's seeing what's actually there. The catechism that Marta is preparing for is the confirmation, we would call it in English. The Cresima in Italian, the Cresima, which is much more of a thing. I remember in England sort of getting you to Holy Communion was kind of, the first Holy Communion was kind of like job done almost. The confirmation was like the cherry on the cake.
I hadn't realized that.
But the confirmation is a really big deal. And, you know, you'll have, you know, the Sundays in which confirmations are done, the restaurants will be booked because everyone will be going out to celebrate the crazy mat. And similarly to the baptisms and the weddings and the, you know, it's just one of those big family feasts. Any excuse for a family feast, frankly.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I think the really interesting thing here is kind of this. Marta is someone who sort of has genuine belief. And there seems to be, that the it seems to be that the church isn't about being a conduit for genuine belief, or you know, or a location for genuine belief. It's for a lot more different. It's for different things, and actually, genuine belief somewhat disturbs it. You know, the priest here. There are two priests who turn up. One is the first one is the sort of parish priest Don Mario, and he's kind of like. Kind of a political figure. He wants to get involved in politics. And well, maybe you can tell us a bit about what did you think of Don Mario?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think he necessarily kind of wants to get involved in politics, but he certainly has ambitions beyond his current role. But I got the sense they were more about kind of progressing in his kind of vocation as a priest, so getting perhaps a bigger or more fashionable or wealthier parish from the one he's in at the moment. He kind of seems to have a bit of an eye on that. And it's kind of talked about, and it comes out at the start of the film that he is potentially going to another parish, and that causes a bit of a crisis of, I mean, not quite a crisis of faith, but for Santa, who is the lady that's running the catechism classes. But also, you know, he is, I don't know, I think a lot of the commentary I've read on the film kind of has him out as almost being the villain of the piece, but I think there's much more nuance in him than that as well. He's obviously not he's not particularly comfortable around children, and he's also not hugely invested in the classes himself. And you know, you kind of see this scene early on where Santa, who is hugely, I think he's hugely enamored by Don Mario, and has kind of, you know, got them to, you know, the class to kind of prepare and work this song, and tries to kind of get them to perform it for his approval. And he, you know, kind of forces himself to say this first verse, and then makes his excuses to kind of go off on his other business. But there's also this kind of element of him being involved in going around signing up people for the elections that are coming. And so right at the start, there's a procession there that is a religious procession, but there are there's a kind of floater, an advertising thing there for one of the parties in the election, and then later in the film we see him going to other kind of parishes trying to get people to sign up to make sure they can vote, and telling them outright as they're doing so, you know, this is the candidate you need to vote for. I've kind of assumed that that's the Christian Democrat candidate, but I don't know enough about Italian politics really to know whether that is that right. Have you got more of a sense of that? Or
is this set in the 80s or is it set in the present day?
I think it's set in the present day, but it feels quite like it's 80s or 90s, doesn't it?
Does it? I mean, Reggio Calabria has that sort of like a little bit stuck in the, I mean, economically, if you haven't developed much economically, it sort of puts you back five, 10 years. The Christian Democrats don't particularly exist anymore. Yeah. They sort of exist in rump sort of the party, and they've sort of splintered into Forza Italia and Berlusconi's party and various other sort of minor right-wing parties. Nowadays, I mean, we're talking about 10 years ago with 2011. So there would be a Christian Democrat sort of version of the Christian Democrats around in those years. So yes, it would be Christian Democrat. Now I'm thinking about it. I mean, that's what I meant by his involvement in politics. Really, not that he's, he's not above. You know, he's got his fingers in he's trying to get his fingers in pies. He strikes me as someone who's not paying attention to the job in hand, and you get the feeling that even if he gets promoted to a better parish, he might be thinking of another one even better rather than and also there's a problem here with Italian priests that, you know, people don't go into the priesthood anymore, so if he goes, who's going to come? Are they going to be a parish without a priest? I live in a village where we share the priest with four or five other villages, and you know, and the churches are empty. You know, my mother-in-law goes to church, and the local priest kind of gave up in the middle of mass at one point and said, "Look, if I haven't got anybody to do the readings, I'm not going on." And the congregation, sort of four or five of them, looked at each other and nobody wanted to get up, so he went, okay, that's the end of the mass, and went. And it's just like, wow. Yeah. So, you know, priests, you can imagine, you know, you used to be a huge figure of prestige and power in the community, and now you're turning up, and maybe there's not the people only ever turn up for funerals and weddings, you know,
yeah,
and baptisms, you know, the usual sort of cliche.
And I think as well, I mean, it's not surprising that you end up with characters like Don Mario in that context, because it must just, you know, I mean, this is true of I suppose, you know, religious leaders in various different denominations and I imagine other faiths as well, that as those kind of congregations are dwindling, it must be a harder and harder role to kind of do and have the same sense of kind of pride and importance, and particularly in Italy, where it was such an elevated role not that long ago, and you know, kind of prestige role, that you can kind of see why people might want to kind of be, well, I mean, I suppose, you know, again, just like any, you know, like most people do in most jobs, they, you know, they want to get on to a, you know, slightly better version of the one they're in, a lot of the time, and to kind of have their own sense of getting somewhere and making a contribution. And I think what's surprising in some ways is that that's not what we normally think of in terms of priests, and that they are, you know, that vocation is seen as one that is so invested in the present, and it's kind of serving that, even though it's got that, you know, I suppose on the one hand, it's got that eternal framework that we don't really think of ambitious priests as a general thing. You get the occasional one pop crops up.
Yeah, it's sort of more Diary of a Country Priest, isn't it?
It's very much like that. So it strikes us as really, you know, he strikes us as very kind of shallow and a false, this guy, and we certainly don't see much of his inner life, I suppose. But you know, but there's also a kind of, yeah, I find it kind of easy to sympathize with his situation, even as much as you want him to be kind of involved in the world he's in, and to kind of invest in the kids and to recognize you know, the work that the Santa and some of the others are doing around the community, and to do it, but you also do see, I think there's just so many moments with him that are just really nicely balanced. And so there's a scene later on in the film where he passes Marta, who's walking away, who should be kind of in the stages of getting ready for the confirmation, and he kind of recognizes her, which is, you know, apart from anything, that's the thing with it. You know, he's invested enough to recognize one of the people that's going through it, and he recognizes that she needs to be somewhere else, but he also seems to kind of recognize slightly that she is vulnerable, but he seems to, you know, lack any ability to get into that, and he's also on his own mission to try and pick up this big, you know, big old kind of beautiful crucifix to kind of bring back to his church, to replace the kind of stylish but out, you know, out of place. It feels more like a kind of something from a 80s Madonna set than
yeah, it's a big electric thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
neon.
It's a big kind of, blue kind of neon thing, which is kind of, I kind of like, yeah, I mean, again, I kind of like it, but I also kind of, you know, see what it stands for in the film as well. And so I mean, again, the risk of boring everyone that's listening by repeating the same thing, but there's just such nuance in him and in all, you know, in all these other characters, and his kind of choices and his motivations.
Yeah, he's played by this wonderful actor who I'll try and pull up his name, Salvatore Cantalupo, who people might remember from the film Gomorrah, in which he has one of the roles as a tailor.
He's like almost the only good character in that film, isn't he? One of the kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting to see. He's just one of the, again, he's a character actor that you see pops up in quite a few Italian films, and he's excellent. I really like naturalistic performances, and he's very good at that. I think that there's two counterpoints that we need to put to Don Mario, and that is one is the congregation itself. To some degree, Marta and Santa are kind of slightly outside of that group, and the other is Don Lorenzo, the priest who Marta meets when they go to the village to get the old crucifix. Let's start with the congregation, because I think you can't really understand Don Mario in this context, this sort of careerist priest, without seeing how the congregation treat the church and treat, you know, I mean, you said right at the very beginning that Marta sort of joins the church basically as a way to integrate into the community, but the community itself treats the church as sort of like a series of hurdles to get over just for the most superficial sort of social inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's like kind of there's numbers at the initial procession, but it feels like on the Sundays it you know, there's not that much going on, and as you say, the confirmation process is seen, as you say, seen as kind of a hurdle, and the kind of people get into, but there's not, you know, there's not a massive amount of kind of genuine belief or real kind of conviction to a lot of the things that are going on. And I mean, I don't know whether this is, yeah. And so when it comes to the actual confirmation service, the church is, aside from a few of the, you know, the people that are taking part in it and their families, the church is still quite empty for quite, you know, it's quite a big space, the church building. It's still relatively empty. There doesn't seem to be a lot of the wider church community that have come up in support of that. I don't know whether that's a factor of how these things work or not, or whether that's a reflection on the church. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that one, but...
Yeah, I mean, and we've read your Calabria as well. You're talking about a community which will probably be more religious than the North, would be more church, attending churches and what have you. And I think it is kind of an age thing. I mean, most people I know, you know, I've been working in schools for decades here, and, you know, the school kids who go through the catechism kind of do so with one eye on the presents that they get from uncles and aunties as much as they do for any sense of sort of spiritual knowledge. Or, I mean, it's different to, you know, I read a lot of Irish literature and, you know, Joyce and Flann O'Brien and people like that. And they're steeped in sort of, I mean, they're from a different epoch, of course, but they're sort of steeped in religious knowledge.
Yeah.
Even if they're rejecting it, they have a, you know, intense relationship to the Bible and to the catechism and to all these things. And that just doesn't seem to exist here. There's a lot. It's, you know, people know about Catholicism and the belief as much as they know about the chemical composition of the air. You know, they're perfectly happy to breathe it in, but it doesn't get much. It doesn't get interrogated much, you know. It doesn't get even, you know, looked at and seen.
And a lot of the questions in the, you know, that they do in the kind of classes, they have these kind of pop quizzes, multiple choice type things, and you know, they're set at the very, you know, at the very lowest common denominator, I suppose. I can't. Well, I'm trying to think what that one is. That you know, what does the church consist of? And it's, you know, or who, or what is the church? Is it the Pope? Is it, I can't remember all the options, but I think the last option is plants or something like that, isn't it? It's, you know, it really is that kind of,
call a friend.
It kind of has that, that element of, you know, some of the, and I can't remember, and some of the other questions as well, they, you know, they have a very, you know, such a kind of basic level of kind of questioning for people that are, you know, supposedly taking a big step in their own religious faith. But
there is a lot of obvious prejudice against the South from the North and vice versa. But obviously when the North is doing it, they're punching down. But there are, for instance, you know, people who can't get their driving licenses in the North go to the South and buy them. You know, you just pay someone at a school and you do the test and you get the license, you know, for cash. You don't have to pass the test, so to speak. So there is that sort of idea of passing a test is not necessarily indicative of anything. You know, you go for an interview for a job and you know somebody's already got it. They'll go through the process, but there's no real interview taking place. And so, I mean, even one of the, there's a bit where Marta is talking to her sort of friends, the same, not really friends because they've only just met really, but, and they're saying like prayers, and the prayers are just little sort of nursery rhymes almost, or pop lyrics that they're saying. And Marta sort of, you know, she has an intense sort of relationship with Jesus. She feels, and God, she has, you know, which is part of what you said at the very beginning, her coming of age. But even that is kind of open to question. I mean, it's seen as something pure in terms of what she's feeling, I think. But whether it is, you know, again, sort of hormones and loneliness, or some a real spiritual connection, Don Lorenzo, who's the old priest, in the village, and this village is very much symbolic, I think, of Italy itself—a sort of deserted, rundown, incredibly photogenic. You know, you sort of think, why are people not living here? This is beautiful compared to sort of the bigger town place, and it has the better crucifix. It's a place you go back to for the sort of classical, old-fashioned thing. But he sort of challenges her and says, you know, your belief in Jesus depends on this sort of image that you've got of him, which isn't actually necessarily true.
Yeah, it's a really kind of fantastic scene between those two. And I think, I mean, I find with Marta, there's a, you know, for a lot of the film, she is kind of approaching everything wide-eyed. And I guess the kind of the choice of actor here really, really helps with that sense. I'm not going to try and say the name. I'm not sure I'm going to get it right, but Il Yara Vianello, who also appears in the Chimera, didn't she? But yeah, she, you know, just kind of her face and her ability to look like she's taking everything in, and it feels like for most of the film she is taking things in and weighing it. I don't think we get a huge amount of insight early in the film as to how she actually feels about what she's going through. She's been told to come to this experience, she's finding it a bit weird and disorientating, and then we get this final scene set in the remote place on the coast, and we see her asking kind of real questions to the priest, and him, you know, he's a very different character from Don Mario. In a sense, he is even less connected to I suppose the kind of ideal image of the priest, in that he, you know, he has a kind of angry and questioning sense of belief, but at the same time, he's also presented as a kind of as a purer figure than Don Mario, because he is seen as someone that the questions actually really matter to, and he's not a career piece. He's, you know, he is at this church that is serving this community that's so deserted that other churches are coming and nicking the cross, and that the church is completely run down and in ruins, and so. And yet he still has this, you know, this stuff still really matters to him. And so when she kind of asks him, he's kind of annoyed. I can't remember what the actual question is that she's asking him, but it's, but he gives this answer of, you know, Jesus kind of like crying out on the cross, and his kind of anger at the world and those kind of things that is completely different. And in fact, when Marta then repeats that back to Don Mario, he has a very extreme reaction, which I won't share for reasons that become be obvious to anyone that's seen the film. But and so I think for her at that point, yeah, that's kind of coming after she is starting to have this realization that what's going on with this process she's going through doesn't sit right with her at all, and there's things that she sees that she can't handle, the kind of the treatment of the cats and the kind of relationship as opposed to nature particularly, which I think her viewing of the world, whether that is in kind of natural things or whether it's, you know, there's a scene early on where she's on a rooftop and she kind of is observing different people at work, just ordinary people kind of going about their things, but kind of almost having this kind of God's eye view of the world that she's looking down on from above. And so there is this real thing of her trying to kind of reconcile those two things together. And I think, again, a lot of the commentary on the film, I think, reflects the perspective of the people that are watching it. You know, some people are very tempted to say she's, you know, rejecting religious faith entirely, which I don't think the film warrants that explanation. And other people are saying, you know, she's kind of moving on to a more mature Faith herself, or, you know, and this is kind of part of, you know, she's just kind of questioning the slightly kind of shammy way that it's done. And I'm not sure it necessarily does that either. I think it, you know, it's very much one of those films that you bring, you know, you bring your stuff to, and it helps you kind of, I suppose, you know, think about that and sift through that and kind of think about it a little bit, because, you know, even right down to the ending, there's a kind of, you know, the ending is very ambiguous, I think.
I mean, when going back to the very beginning, actually, when we were talking about how this relates to our own life experience and relationship with the church, or with religious faith in general, I think this struck me as really fascinating how it portrays how disturbing the organized church finds genuine faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how it upsets the, you know, it's kind of like the church will have this thing of saying, you know, you only want us for weddings and funerals, and you only, you know, you don't really think about it, and you don't really. But if you then go and say, well, actually, I really am thinking about it, and I'm really deeply involved in it, it'll be like, whoa, back off there. You know, yeah. I mean, I remember the two moments at which the priests were kind of at a loss for words when I was, you know, and I knew several priests because they were involved in the school and in religious education as well as the church. Churches I would attend, and I'd go and say to them, oh, I might have a vocation, and that would be very frightening for them. It was all like, oh, I don't know if I want to have the responsibility of this, you know. And then when I was losing my faith, likewise, I would, on the insistence of my mum, I would go and say, okay I've lost my faith totally, you know, let's talk about it. And they would be like, they'd shrug, it would, you know, oh, well, yeah. You know, it's almost like nothing, you're no longer a customer at my shop, you know. And I think that's Martha's situation, is that, and a little bit Santa as well, that they're kind of pushing a door that they think should be swinging open, and then in fact it's resisting them.
Yeah, I mean, there's that kind of, I mean... I suppose perhaps the truest villain of the piece is the kind of the bishop's assistant character, and when he and the bishop turn up for the kind of confirmation and Don Mario's not there, you know, Santa is kind of left trying to host there. And I mean, I feel like I've given a very positive account of her character so far, which is certainly not the only way she's portrayed in the film.
Yeah, but, well, why don't we describe her a little bit, because we brought her up a couple of times. Give us a little bit more about Santa.
Yeah, so she's kind of got this motherly figure to the kids going through the classes. And, you know, in contrast to Don Mario, this stuff really seems to mean a lot to her. It's not just about giving these kids the minimum to get through. She genuinely seems to think this is the best way of communicating these things to the children. And, you know, and perhaps she's even right about some of that thing, you know, difficult to know, but also she is also kind of a bit brusque with some of those things, and isn't necessarily as, you know, accepting of Martha as she could be. And there's one particular scene where she trips over and you know, all the kind of class laugh at it, because, you know, it's the teacher falling on the floor, and you know, it's slightly kind of slapstick, and Martha laughs about it a little bit longer than the others. The other kind of realize, okay, this hasn't gone right, and it's time to stop laughing, and she just kind of laughs a little bit longer, and then Santa is clearly then very angry and ends up kind of, and the following thing that they're doing in the class happens to be a kind of mention of a slap across the face, and she chooses Martha to demonstrate this, and puts more into the slap than was necessary for demonstration purposes, shall we say.
Yeah, she gets her own back, and, you know, a very unchristian sort of she's not turning the other cheek in terms of...
and it's quite a shocking moment. And partly because she doesn't immediately go into the kind of thing of regret, or immediately go into the thing of, you know, pushing it further. There's just this kind of uncomfortable moment when she knows she's crossed the line, but she's also completely unable or unwilling to address that and redress that and try and make things. You know, I suppose it's a kind of classic institutional arrangement in that sense. But yeah, but so then the bishop and the assistant turn up, and she's trying to kind of host them, and I think she's partly got this kind of concern about Don Mario leaving and what that means to the community and what that means to her personally, probably presumably an even more higher workload, but also on a faith level as well. But also she's completely brushed off by the assistant and the bishop, who seem to have no interest in the ordinary people that make up the church. And you know, they've come to this community, seem to be expected to be hosted by the priest, and that's, other than a bit of kind of blessing during the service, that's where their interest in what's happening seems to kind of begin and end. And so and there's just a line from that, you know, from that guy says, and says, you know, who are you in the church, is, I think, is the line he says to her. And she doesn't really have anything to say, you know, you kind of feel that she, you know, in another film, she might kind of reel off a long speech about, you know, how people like her are keeping the church running and, you know, and really kind of give it to them. But it's, you know, it's such a kind of, it's asked as a question, but it's such a stinging rebuke, really, of what she does and her importance. And this kind of, you know, almost this sense of why, you know, why would the bishop want to meet the ordinary people?
And I mean, that question goes to the heart of what happens in the church as well, that there's always a woman who does everything. There's always, you know, it's sometimes Italy is described as a matriarchy, not in the sense of in opposition to the patriarchy, but it's just like you have one mother figure who runs everything for the men. You know, it's another type of patriarchy in that sense.
Yeah.
But that the authority of the mother figure also utterly relies on being the sort of sergeant major rather than the sort of officer class. And so, yeah, she doesn't have an official title. She's not getting money from the church. She's turning up early in the morning and arranging the flowers and dealing with the kids and everything. And if she didn't, you know, and in return, what she gets is she gets an importance and a visibility in the community that also, again, depends on the church being important and visible. You know, these figures that I've observed in real life can often be as much objects of ridicule as they can respect. You know, it's like, yeah, the kids have to deal with them, but once the kids hit a certain age, then, you know, they've treat them with contempt. You know, they've passed that point where their authority is respected. So the tripping over and the kids laughing perfectly represents that dynamic of like, we're only putting up with you until we've got our confirmation, and then, you know, you're no longer going to be the sort of youth leader.
And her sense as well that if Don Mario leaves, then the, you know, the church will kind of fall slightly, and she'll be kind of held up as a figure of ridicule rather than a kind of important figure that she's on that tightrope, really, between being a woman of significance and being a, you know, being someone on the ground being laughed at by the people that are meant to be upholding her or respecting her.
Absolutely. And then if another priest might come in and just say, look, I'm going to do things differently, and you're no longer needed. I'm going to take over. And she'd have no, you know, we've already seen she can't write to the bishop and say, look, and it's a difficult thing when you put your identity into an institution that doesn't have any, in which you have no formal place and which has actually no real interest in you. Whereas the bishop and his assistant and Don Mario, it reminds me of Alan Bennett talking about how any institution is there for its own survival, not for the thing it purports to be for. So, you know, a hospital isn't there for the patients, it's there for the doctors. And a church is there for the priests and the bishops, it's not there for the congregation.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Yeah, and she, just the kind of dynamic between her and Don Mario and as, you know, as well as those other characters, she kind of really, she encapsulates so much. I think it would be it's a film about Martha and her experiences and what she's going through. And so much of it is done from her point of view, and particularly how the camera's used and everything. But without that kind of the kind of Santa character, without the Don Mario characters, you know, those things really, and the fact that we do get time with them when Martha's not there, it just kind of really helps, I suppose, kind of add, you know, roll out the, a kind of territory map and help us kind of see, you know, understand the broader perspective of what's going on and the broader dynamics that are at play. That you wouldn't, you know, it would be weird for a 13-year-old to kind of be party to all of that and to kind of be able to appreciate that on their own. And so it's kind of really, it's really well done.
Yeah, I think that this also goes to the earlier films, the subsequent films, sorry, that Roaka makes, so that she's interested in communities. Those are the, that's the one thing that goes through all of her films.
Yeah, and these... even some of her short films as well. Well, she's made a kind of a few quirky, like kind of short films. And so there's one where she is kind of a funeral parade that is a kind of, I mean, it's, you know, it's much more the kind of thing you'd find in a gallery than in a cinema, but is, you know, a bunch of people kind of carrying out these giant printouts of her and kind of burying them in the ground. But it's kind of got very cinema focus. And then during lockdown, she made a film where she essentially, I think it was called Four Roads. And she essentially goes from where she lives and to kind of and interviews her neighbors at a distance and talks about them and who they are and what she, you know, and kind of, and as she's kind of walking on each of these kind of roads in the different directions to her neighbors. But I think particularly that there's something in that about that sense of, you know, community and place and longing that really comes out. But as you say, it's very much, you know, all her films have this kind of community feel. So in Laramavilia, you have, I mean, essentially it's a family, but you also have these extra figures being brought into that kind of family unit. And then in Lazzaro Felice, you have the, you know, the kind of community of workers on the farm that have such, you know, that are kind of live all together in these terrible surroundings, but form these bonds that kind of continue way beyond the initial phase of the story. And yeah, and so. Yeah, so that is, as you say, that's a real thread running through that kind of idea of community and you know, the connection between people and the importance of that and how that still has to function. And yeah, that's certainly a very big concern of hers.
Yeah, and it's sort of like individual community world. There's a real sort of tripartite division in her films, that these relationships between those three things are, you know, Marta's relationship to her Santa and the immediate group that she's with and the priest Don Mario, and then that's group's relationship with Santa, with to the bishop and the world, and you know, to some degree, you know, the Don Lorenzo's relationship to the world that's been completely left him behind. Go ahead.
I was going to say it'd be really good to talk about some of the imagery of the film as well, I think.
Yeah, because, please do.
Well, I think that, you know, there's just some incredibly startling imagery through the film. Yeah, I mean, it's shot on 16mm, which. Even I think, you know, even at the time was probably kind of has that retro feel about it, and almost I think why it, you know, it does feel, when we're saying, does it, you know, is the 80s or 90s or the noughties, it you know, it does feel like it's kind of difficult to place for that reason. But there are, you know, there are just some moments, just some moments of incredible imagery. So there's one where Marta's bursts out of the class and kind of marches down the street, and all around her, I mean, there is this kind of this. She's walking with a kind of wind behind her, and then it's kind of blowing the rubbish around her, all up in there, and in a kind of, I mean, not quite a tempest, but it's, I mean, it's a, you know, it's an amazing, it's just an amazing scene. And you kind of think about back to the early noughties, about how excited everyone was getting about the carrier bag in American Beauty. Yeah. And it just, you know, it just kind of blows that out of the water. But also the imagery with the kind of this crucifix that we've kind of talked about. And just the way, you know, there's just one scene where Marta's just very kind of tenderly kind of cleaning the dust off it that is really striking. I mean, again, you know, there's a scene shortly afterwards. In that scene that again involves that crucifix, which again I don't want to kind of talk about too much for those people that haven't seen it, but again, you know, I mean, again, that just the imagery that's going on with what happens in that scene and subsequently is you feel like entire papers could be written about some of these things.
When you talked earlier about how it relates to neorealism and so, to some degree you know, Italians, it's a little bit like Russian cinema and Tarkovsky, you know. You're just in a constant dialogue with the dead. Italian cinema, I think, feel like has sort of two grandpappies that it needs to deal with. And one is neorealism and the other is Federico Fellini. And I think Rohrwacher is kind of in the middle of those. And I think there's a lot of what Fellini, you know, helped write the script of Roma Città Aperta, so he's not divorced from neorealism. He's coming out of it himself, but he's definitely he brings out a strain of the operatic that was in neorealism. I don't think neorealism is a documentary realism in any way, shape or form. Bicycle Thieves, for instance, I think is a hugely operatic film. And those images that you're talking about, you know, the images of what goes on with the crucifix, the image of Marta and the sort of pathetic fallacy of the of the weather. She's feeling stormy inside and the weather outside is, you know, she's like a little witch walking down that street as if she's sort of the weather is directly expressing her emotional turmoil. It feels like it's coming from a sort of Fellini-esque sort of grandeur in a neorealistic setting, you know, in a neorealistic sort of context.
I think that's definitely true. There's a kind of certain level where it just ups things a little bit. I mean, yeah, there's kind of various talk about kind of magical realism, and I'm not sure how much of that is a useful label necessarily, particularly for this film. I mean, it comes out in different elements, perhaps in a film, but only as very kind of short bursts. But I think that's part of the driving force, is that kind of Fellini sense of, you know, of opera or the kind of, you know, the heightened drama of those things. That's certainly true. There are kind of moments where it just nudges beyond the thing of what you expect, and yet it somehow feels like, you know, it really kind of belongs to that film. Those moments don't feel like they're kind of fake and they're forced and they're kind of fantasy to the extent of Fellini, but they have a kind of exaggeration that really boils down the kind of essence of what is going on and expresses it visually, which I think is what makes it such a powerful film for me anyway.
I mean, it's so difficult for Italian filmmakers because, you know, La Dolce Vita begins with this crucifix flying over Rome. And any time you have a bigger than normal crucifix, it's going to be like, okay, you're referencing Fellini. It's like, well, crucifixes are fairly common in Italy. He did it so definitively that you feel like any big crucifix moving about is going to be a self-conscious reference to him, but not necessarily so.
And I think it does quite well at burying that as well as it obviously being there. You know, there is a transportation of the crucifix and there's a kind of critical moment, but it's not kind of like, I think in a less skillful filmmaker's hands, that sequence would feel like, here we go with the... with a Fellini nod and kind of really ramming it down your throats, where it's much subtler than that, I think.
Absolutely. Listen, Matthew, it's been wonderful talking to you about Corpo Celeste, or Corpo Celeste, I should say, sorry. Is there anything you feel we haven't covered in our conversation that you'd like to, any sort of final comment?
I think there's just one scene that I feel is a bit of a misstep, which is the scene of Marta in the bathroom, and it's kind of one of those films you occasionally get shots in films. I mean, there was always a lot of talk growing up about whether scenes are artistically justified or not, and I think it's one of those scenes that is artistically justified in one sense, but also I feel uncomfortable, I suppose, within a post Me Too world, but it doesn't really, you know. Whereas it doesn't feel like the kind of consent of the, you know, working with a young actor, the consent of that actor is is necessary. You know, it feels just a little bit exploitative there, and I do wonder if she were making this film today, whether she would still include that scene. For those reasons, which is funny because from a kind of artistic angle, it feels like it works, and it gives us an additional insight into her and what she's going through. But I guess where film as a medium is different to, say, painting or some other mediums, that, there are real people behind the characters we see on the screen, and it feels like that's, I feel uncomfortable with that. With that scene.
Yeah, I also think sort of art house cinema, especially internationally, and Me Too has not had an impact on Italy to any extent whatsoever. I mean, they're very, very, I mean, it wasn't necessarily helped that the biggest champion or the most vocal advocate was Asia Argento, who herself then became accused of similar sexual harassment cases against an underage actor in one of her films that she was directing. I think in Europe there tends to be this idea that, especially in a certain sort of level of sort of realist cinema, shall we say, treating animals badly and child nudity seem to be almost like de rigueur signs of authenticity, of like, yeah, we're not afraid to go there. And there's a sort of edgelordness about it, and I'm sure it's not thought of in that way, but I'm always a little bit like, oh, come on, Bellatar, you don't have to hurt the cat that much, you know.
And it
just feels like there's almost an art house machismo. I'm not scared of, you know, Michael Haneke and etc. You know, I'm not scared of thrusting this stuff in your face, and as you sit and eat your hamburger and criticize me for this. And it's just like, well, it's animal cruelty, man. It's not. And you know, as you say, you know, people grow up and that film is going to be forever, and they're going to be, you know, it sounds like she's fine with it because she's now acting in another, she appeared in another film. And so that's great. But yeah, as you say, you know, issues of consent, and you wonder if, you know, just a certain constraint for certain filmmakers, certain mindfulness, will just probably lead to more artful solutions, you know, rather than not doing it at all or not. But how could I get the point across in another way which doesn't expose my actor to this, you know, using doubles, using different angles, or just, you know, not being so explicit. Brilliant. Well, listen, Matthew, that I hear rumours that you're working on something directly involving Italian cinema, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a longer term thing, but I'm kind of trying to put together a kind of introduction to Italian cinema that I think that is perhaps aimed less at kind of university undergrads and more about. You know, ordinary people with a kind of passion for cinema, really. So, so trying to write something kind of short, you know, kind of short and quite accessible. But, it's going to be a long term project, I think, because, I have a lot else on my plate. So,
but that sounds wonderful. It sounds like it's needed, and it sounds it's exactly the sort of thing that I'm trying to do with this podcast in a way.
Well, I think they're happy bedfellows. I think it, you know, I think that's what's great about this podcast is that it does, you know, take these films and make them accessible and give a good chat about them, and you know, really engage them today. So.
Arrivederci ragazzi, ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.